All the King's Horses, 3. The junkyard sat hard by the oily green waters of New York Bay, way at the end of Hook Road. Tom got there early, undid the padlock, and swung open the gates and the high chain-link fence. He parked his Honda beside the sagging tin-roofed shack where Joey DeAngelis had once lived with his father, Dom, back in the days when the junkyard had been a going concern, and sat for a moment with his arms folded across the top of the steering wheel, remembering. He'd spent endless Saturday afternoons inside that shack, back when it had still been habitable, reading old issues of Jet Boy to Joey after they'd heisted their comic book collections back from a PTA bonfire. Over there, back behind the shed, was where Joey used to work on his cars, long before he'd turned into Junkyard Joey DeAngelis, King of the Demolition Derby Circuit. And way in back where no one ever went, behind that mountain of rusted junkers, that was where he and Joey had welded armor plate over the frame of a VW Beetle to make the first shell. Later, much later, after Dom had died and Tom had bought the junkyard from Joey and shut it down, they'd dug the bunker under the junkyard. But they hadn't been that sophisticated at the start. A greasy tarp was about all the concealment they had. Tom climbed out of the car and stood with his hands shoved deep into the pockets of his shapeless, old brown suede jacket, breathing the salt air off the bay. It was a chilly day. Out across the water, a garbage barge passed slowly, flocks of seagulls circling around it like feathered flies. You could see the vague outline of the Statue of Liberty, but Manhattan had vanished in the morning haze. Vanished or not, it was out there, and on a clear night, you could see the lights shining off the towers. A hell of a view. In Hoboken and Jersey City, run-down houses and cramped condos that offered views like this went for six figures. Constable Hook was zoned for industrial use, and Tom's land was surrounded by an import-export warehouse, a railroad siding, a sewage treatment plant, and an abandoned oil refinery. But Steve Bruder said that none of that mattered. That big of a chunk of land, right on the waterfront, it was just prime for development, Bruder had said, when Tom told him he was thinking of selling the old junkyard. He should know, he'd already made himself a millionaire, with real estate speculation in Hoboken and Weehawken, rehabilitating old tenements into expansive condos for yuppies from Manhattan. Bayonne was next, Steve said. In 10 years, all this Rust Belt industry would be gone, replaced by new housing developments. But they could be first and make the biggest killing. Tom had known Steve Bruder since childhood and cordially loathed him most of that time. But for once, Bruder's words were music to his ears. When Bruder offered to buy the junkyard outright, the price made Tom's head spin. But he resisted the temptation. He'd thought this all out beforehand. No, he said, I'm not selling. I want to be a full partner in the development. I provide the land, you provide the money and know-how. We split the profits 50-50. Bruder had given him a shark's slow smile. You're not as dumb as you look, Tudbury. Someone been coaching you, or is this all your own idea? Maybe I've finally gotten smart, Tom said. Now what is it? Yes or no? Shit or get off the pot, asshole. It's not nice to call your partner an asshole, wimp, Bruder said, extending his hand. He had a very firm handshake, but Tom was careful not to wince. Tom looked at his watch. Steve would be bringing the bankers by in about an hour. Just a formality, he said. The loan would be candy. The property screamed with potential. Once they had the line of credit, they could get the zoning changed. By spring, they'd have the junk cleared out and the land subdivided into building lots. Tom wasn't sure why he'd come so early, unless it was just to remember. It was funny that so many of his important memories were rooted in this junkyard, but somehow, appropriate, considering the way his life had gone. But all of that was about to change, forever. Thomas Tudbury was about to become a rich man. Tom walked slowly around the shack, kicked at a threadbare tire in his path, then lifted it with his mind. He held it 5 feet off the ground, gave it a brisk telekinetic shove that set it spinning, and counted. At 8, the tire began to wobble. At 11, it fell. Not bad. Back in his teens, before he'd crawled into a shell, he could have held that tire up all day. But that was when the power had been Tom's, before he'd given it away to the turtle, like he'd given so much else. "Sell the junkyard?" Joey had said when Tom told him the plan. "You're serious about this, aren't you? That's one hell of a bridge to burn. What if they find the bunker?" "They'll find a fucking hole in the ground. Maybe they'll worry about it for 5-10 minutes. Then they'll push some dirt into it, and it'll be over." "What about the shells?" "There are no shells," Tom said. "Just some junk that used to be shells. All the king's horses and all the king's men, remember? I'll go out there one night and turn turtle just long enough to drop them into the bay." "Hell of a waste," Joey said. "Weren't you the one telling me how much money and sweat you put into those fucking things?" He took a long swig of beer and shook his head. Joey looked more like his father, Dom, every year. The same skinny arms, the same rock-hard beer belly, the same salt-and-pepper hair. Tom remembered when it had been pure black, always falling down into his eyes. In those days, before pull tabs, Joey used to wear a church key around his neck on a leather thong, even when he'd donned a cheap frog mask and gone to Jokertown with the turtle to help roust Dr. Tachyon from an alcoholic pout. That was 23 years ago. Tachyon hadn't aged, but Joey had, and so had Tom. He'd grown old without growing up, but all that was changing now. The turtle was dead, but Tom Tudbury's life had just begun. He strolled away from the shoreline. Broken headlights stared at him like so many blind eyes from mountains of dead cars. And once he felt live eyes and turned to see a huge gray rat peering out of the damp, rotten interior of a legless Victorian sofa. In the depths of the junkyard, he passed between two long rows of vintage refrigerators, all the doors carefully removed. On the far side was a flat, bare patch of earth where a square metal plate was set into the ground. It was heavy. Tom knew from past experience. He stared at the big ring set into the metal, concentrated, and on the third try, he managed to shift it enough to reveal the dark tunnel mouth below. Tom sat on the edge of the hole and dropped down carefully into darkness. At the bottom, he fumbled against the wall and found the flashlight he'd hung there, then walked down the cold, damp tunnel until he emerged in the bunker. The old shells waited for him in silence. He'd have to get rid of them soon, he knew, but not today. The bankers wouldn't go poking around back here. They just wanted to eyeball the property, see the view, maybe sign a few papers. There was plenty of time to dump this junk in the bay. It wasn't going anywhere. Painted daisies and peace symbols covered shell too. The once bright paint now faded and chipped. Just looking at it was enough to bring back memories of old songs, old causes, old certainties. The March on Washington, folk rock blaring from his speakers, "Make love, not war," scrawled across his armor. Gene McCarthy had stood on that shell and spoken with his customary wry eloquence for a solid 20 minutes. Pretty girls in halter tops and jeans would fight for the chance to ride on top. Tom remembered one in particular, with cornflower blue eyes beneath an Indian headband and straight blonde hair that fell past her ass. "She loved him," she'd whispered, as she lay across the shell. She wanted him to open the hatch, let her in. She wanted to see his face and look into his eyes. She didn't care if he was a joker like they said. She loved him, and she wanted him to ball her right then, right there. She'd given him a hard-on that felt like a crowbar in his jeans, but he hadn't opened the shell. Not then, not ever. She wanted the turtle, but inside the armor was only Tom Tutbury. He wondered where she was now, what she looked like, what she remembered. By now, she might have a daughter, as old as she'd been the night she tried to crawl inside his shell. Tom ran his hand over the cold metal and traced another peace symbol in the dust that lay thick on the armor. He'd really felt as though he was making a difference in those days. He was a part of a movement, stopping a war, protecting the weak. The day the turtle had made Nixon's enemy list had been one of the proudest of his life. All the king's horses and all the king's men. Beyond the painted shell was another hulk, larger, plainer, more recent. That one had seen some hard service, too. He paused by the dent where some lunatic had bounced a cannonball off him. His head was ringing for weeks afterward. Underneath, Tom knew if you looked in the right place, you could find the imprint of a small human hand sunk 4 inches deep into the armor plate, a souvenir left him by a rogue ace the press called the Sculptress. She was a cute bit of business. Metal and stone flowed like water under her hands. She was a media darling until she started using those hands to shape doorways into bank vaults. The turtle delivered her to the cops, wondering how they were going to stop her from just walking out again. But she never tried it. Instead, she'd accepted a pardon and gone to work for the Justice Department. Sometimes, it was a very strange world. There wasn't much left of either shells 2 or 3, except for the frame and armor plate. The interiors had long since been gutted for parts. Cameras, electronics, heaters, fans, you name it. All that stuff cost money, of which Tom had never had an overabundance. So you borrowed from the old shells to build the new where you could. It didn't help much. It still cost a fortune. By his rough figuring, he'd had about 50 grand tied up in the shell the goddamn Takesians had so casually spit out the airlock. Most of it borrowed. He was still making payments. In the darkest corner of the bunker, he found the oldest shell of all. Even the layers of badly welded armor plate couldn't quite obliterate the familiar lines of the VW Beetle they'd started with, back in the winter of 1963. Inside, he knew it was dark and stuffy, with barely enough room to turn around, and none of the amenities of the later shells. Shining the flashlight over the exterior, he sighed at his naivete. Black and white TV sets, a Volkswagen body, 20-year-old electrical wire, vacuum tubes. It was more or less intact, if only because it was so hopelessly obsolete. The very idea that he'd crossed the bay in it just a few months prior made him want to shudder. Still, it was the first shell, with the strongest memories of all. He looked at it for a long time, remembering how it had been. Building it, testing it, flying it. He remembered the first time he'd crossed over to New York. He'd been scared shitless. Then, he'd found the fire, TK'd that woman to safety. Even now, all these years later, he could see the dress she'd been wearing vividly in his mind's eye, the flames licking up the fabric as he'd floated her down to the street. "I tried," he said aloud. His voice echoed strangely in the dimness of the bunker. "I did some good." He heard scrabbling noises behind him. Rats, probably. It had gotten so bad that he was talking to rats. Who was he trying to convince? He looked at the shells, 3 of them in a crooked row, so much scrap metal destined for the bottom of the bay. It made him sad. He remembered what Joey had said about what a waste it was, and that gave him the beginnings of an idea. Tom pulled a pad out of his back pocket and jotted a quick note to himself, smiling. He'd been playing shell games for 20 years, and he never did find the pea beneath any of them. Well, maybe he could turn the old shells into a whole can of peas. Steve Bruder arrived 45 minutes later, wearing leather driving gloves and a Burberry coat, with two bankers in his long brown Lincoln Town car. Tom let him do all the talking as they walked around the property. The bankers admired the view and politely deigned not to notice the junkyard rats. They signed the papers that afternoon and celebrated with dinner at Hendrickson's.